Good afternoon. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order. Time is 1:35 p.m., 5th of February, 2014. Joining me today is Senator Kelly, Senator Ellis, and myself, Senator Stedman. We have a couple items today. We're going to have two presentations on the topic of program integrity and fraud control in the Medicaid and public assistance programs. And we're going to have a testimony is by invitation only, and we will not be taking public testimony today. We've invited Commissioner Bill Stewart from the Department of Health and Social Services, as well as Assistant Attorney General Andrew Peterson, the Director of Medicaid Fraud Control Unit in the Department of Law. And I'd like the record to reflect that Senator Machicki is with us. And also, at our last committee meeting, Senator Machicki joined us shortly after the hearing started, and I neglected to note the record, and I'd like it to reflect that Senator Machicki joined that committee at approximately 1:45 p.m. on Monday, February 23rd. It's important to Senator Machicki. He wants to run a perfect score as long as possible, and we're going to help him do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. And if we could have the commissioner come forward, please. I guess the Assistant Attorney General. And I'll let you guys just go ahead and take it away. I think the commissioner's going to have the presentation, and you want to hang around and work with the Department of Law and theirs. Is that correct?
Okay. Yes, sir.
So if you can identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and take us through your presentation, please.
For the record, my name is Bill Stewart. I'm the commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services, and I'm here today to present to you on program integrity and fraud control. My overview is going to basically be a kind of front-end overview leading into giving Assistant Attorney General Peterson work to do. So, and he'll pick up from there as to their side of the partnership that we have between the two entities. With that, I'll dive right into it. There's a lot of Alaskans in need, and I think you all are acutely aware of the size of our budget. $2.667 billion this year, and the need to spend the dollars wisely, to spend them appropriately, to spend them honestly, and to spend them in the best ways that we can to reach those in the greatest need for care. It's the right thing to do. Secondly, it's a practical thing to do. With the budget, you don't want me giving out money to people who inappropriately use it or aren't using it in the manner in which it's intended. And thirdly, we have to ensure that the funding goes to where it can have the greatest impact. And pretty much the direction that we're going, and so I'm going to give you a quick overview of what we're doing in the department before I hand it over to Andrew. Recipient fraud is primarily controlled through the Public Assistance Fraud Control Unit, and I'll go into that. Welfare Fraud Section, Office of Special Prosecution and Appeals is in law. And then finally, Provider Fraud, Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. Medicaid Fraud Control is either recipient or provider. We're talking about impact money-wise. It's going to be almost exclusively on the provider end. On the recipient end, it's going to be more in terms of the prevention by identifying people ahead of time as to their appropriate filing in those areas. Medicaid Program Integrity Unit is to, I'm not going to read this for you, but it's basically to preserve and protect the integrity of the Medicaid program. We have seven staff located within our Healthcare Services Division, the Medicaid shop. Primary mission is to preserve and protect the integrity of the Medicaid program by proactively developing strategies to identify, deter, and prevent fraud. We get into waste and abuse as well by doing records checks, looking at the type of care that was provided. Is it the right care, the right time, the right place for the right person? The program integrity section is the liaison with Department of Law, Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. They conduct primarily claims reviews. They manage the audit contract that was established under AS 4705-200. with Meyer and Stauffer. I'm sure you all hear about them on a regular basis. The fact that we do those audits, we do 70 a year, and they manage that contract and any actions that we take as a result of that contract.
Question, Mr. Yes. Chairman.
Senator Machicki?
Yeah, through the chair, Commissioner Stewart, are the audits random on a net basis, or how do you decide who's audited?
Senator Machicki, through the chair, they're random. We randomly select 65 of them, and then five are targeted of the rest of the list. We look at, have they been audited recently? Do they have audit history that still has some stuff dragging that was never closed out, never completed, never adequately responded to? But 65 are random selection. So it's sometimes somebody will get hit two or three times in multiple years, and then somebody might not get hit for 5 years.
Thanks.
They. Program Integrity Section does a good job. They identified $6.2 million in overpayments last year. They recovered 4.9. You say, what's the difference? Why didn't you recover everything? It may be under protest. It may be that we've identified that they did have legitimate reason for not having to have that recovered against them. A variety of reasons as to it, and I could give you detail on that if you wanted it further. We suspended payment to 56 providers based on credible allegation of fraud. I think Andrew is, Attorney General Peterson is probably going to tell you that we're only beginning in terms of our efforts in that area. We re-procured the audit contract with Meyer and Stauffer that I already spoke about. Feds have a variety of audits that they are undertaking because they believe that there's a tremendous amount of fraud in the Medicaid and Medicare worlds, and that some of the funding, some of the expenses of the Affordable Care Act can be underwritten by those recoveries and beginning to getting much more enforcement there. So one of those is recovery audit contractor. The RAC audits, as they're called, and those audits are through a procurement with a national contractor. We contract as a state, but it's through the federal process. They conducted 142 audits recently. Participated in four on-site investigations in collaboration with the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, and that, to me, I think, is the area that we need to step up and work more diligently in cooperation with Medicaid Fraud Control Unit on, because I think that's where our greatest opportunity for recoveries are in the department. Division of Public Assistance investigates allegations of applicant fraud, recipient fraud, and that's where we get into more of a prevention effort. We get a hold of them ahead of time, then we stop it before payments are made. And we collaborate with federal and state agencies. We work on administrative sanctions, at times in criminal prosecutions, and are located throughout the state, as you can see. Do a lot of data mining through Public Assistance Fraud Unit. Data mining is going in and taking a look at various databases. To identify people that are or are not eligible for public assistance, Medicaid, temporary assistance for needy families, or other programs of the state. We go to the Correction Offender Management System to identify felons who felt we cannot provide benefits to felons through the process. And so it's amazing what that has allowed us to garner in terms of paying for the right care for these individuals. I'm not going to read through the list because of this, but there's a lot of data mining that is done, and it's maximizing the information system that's out there to our benefit. the fraud control accomplishments, about $10 million combined amount of cost avoidance, fraud claims, and or direct savings. I tell you right now that the majority of it is in terms of cost avoidance. We identify a person not being eligible before payments are made. Because so often what they're once they're made, you got to catch them, and then you've got to find them, and then you've got to prosecute them. Excuse me, you got to find them, catch them, and prosecute them. And we have applicant fraud of $1.68 million. We have categorically ineligible investigations of 6.45. As I said, that's where the majority of it is. Recipient fraud, a small amount in terms of the overall fraud possibility, 441,000. And of those, 12 fraud convictions for about $200,000. More on the next page that you have. I'm not going to go through those with any detail. And with that, that concludes my portion of the presentation. I'll turn it over to Assistant Attorney General Peterson.
Do we have any questions for the Commissioner for the next presentation? Okay, with that, Mr. Peterson.
Senator Sedman. I have a presentation here I'm just going to read from as opposed to doing the PowerPoint. And I'll start by giving.
Can you start by telling us who you are?
I apologize, sir. It's Andrew Peterson. I'm the Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law and the Office of Special Prosecutions, and I'm the Director for the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. What I wanted to do is start off by just kind of giving an overview of the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, what it is that we do, what our goals are, and how we are trying to collaborate with the Department of Health to achieve those goals. And obviously be willing to answer any questions along the way to clarify any of these issues. The Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act of 1993 established the Medicaid Fraud Control Units. It required all states to establish a unit. We are required to meet certain standards in our recertification annually and have minimum personnel requirements. By meeting these standards, the federal government provides 75% of our funding in order to achieve our objectives.
Could I get you to pull your mics up a little bit? Just that way, I want to make sure that it's picked up.
Looks like a rookie maneuver, huh?
That's right. It's only water, won't hurt.
That's okay. If I keep this up, I won't get invited back, so that's maybe the good thing.
No, you're making us look great.
There's something to that. The Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, when it comes to investigating crimes, focuses on a few select areas, and these are regulated by our federal grant. Those areas are medical assistance fraud, allegations of abuse or neglect, and financial exploitation or misappropriation of patient funds. And all of these are with respect to agencies that receive Medicaid dollars. One of the other areas that that we focus on, separate from the criminal prosecution, is global recoveries. And there's a couple of areas in which you'll see global recoveries coming back to the state. One is through the National Association of Medicaid Fraud Control Units. There will be class action suits filed in federal court around the country. We join those suits and seek recovery for things like misallocation of drugs or kickback schemes that are happening through drug companies that are deemed to be inappropriate, but probably not criminal. And in those cases, we join the suit. Generally, it brings back to the state about $1.5 million a year in civil recoveries. On the other side, the Department of Law, through Ed Sniffen, does civil suits by the state of Alaska, and generally we see around $4 or $5 million a year in recovery from those suits. So those are two civil areas that we deal with, but due to the size of our unit, it's not a we're not directly involved in the civil suits, but we do join those class actions. The Medicaid Fraud Control Unit does have certain limitations, as I indicated, with respect to our federal grant. One of those limitations is we don't focus on non-Medicaid cases. If I am prosecuting a case involving a Medicaid provider, I am at that point eligible to bring in any charges that are that fall under state law. But if there needs to be a Medicaid hook for me to get in the door. The second thing is we don't prosecute recipient fraud alone. If the case involves a provider colluding with the recipient to defraud Medicaid, then I will charge both the provider and the recipient. If it is just a situation of the recipient defrauding the system, then that goes to our Department of Public Assistance prosecutor within the Office of Special Prosecutions. In the last area, you heard the commissioner mention data mining, which is done by Program Integrity to try and identify fraudulent conduct by healthcare providers. The Medicaid Fraud Control Unit is not allowed to data mine until we have a credible allegation of fraud or a referral from the Department of Health. At that point, we are able to utilize the resources that we have to try and prove or ferret out the fraud, but it requires a referral to us first before we do that. One of the other limitations placed on the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit by the federal funding is that we have to be a separate and distinct entity from that of the Department of Health. So on slide 5, you can see how the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit falls directly under the Attorney General's department, where our counterpart, where we get our referrals from, and the agency that we work directly with, the Department of Health, although we work side by side, we are independent from them, so we have our own independent discretion and judgment when it comes to prosecuting cases. And the last requirement for our federal funding is the federal grant requires that all Medicaid fraud control units have an assistant attorney general or a prosecutor, a financial auditor or CPA, and finally at least one chief investigator. Within Alaska, our unit consists of myself. I'm the only prosecutor in the unit. We have an auditor position who's a CPA, and we have 6 investigators total, one chief investigator and 5 investigator 3 positions. On page 7, the funding for the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit. The top line there, I just want to clarify, that is the years identified here are federal fiscal years running from October 1st through September 31st each year. There's a couple of key factors that I would like to point out here on this page. You'll notice that our funding went up from 2011 to 2012. That was the year that the legislature graciously gave us 3 additional investigator positions. So we went from 3 investigators to 6 investigators, and with the auditor, it gives us a total of 7 positions. You will also notice that the number of investigations, there's kind of a downward trend, and that's intentional. We have been working with the Department of Health to improve the quality of the referrals that are coming to my unit. The Department of Law is set up. We generally receive investigations or criminal cases from Anchorage Police Department or the state troopers, and they screen cases for, you know, they're looking at them to determine what is a prosecutable case or not, and then they give it to us to make the final decision. Historically, the way it worked is we would receive all referrals from the Department of Health, and then we had to screen out what was a prosecutable case and what wasn't. The problem with that was that my investigators were spending a significant amount of time screening cases as opposed to investigating and prosecuting cases. So we've been working with Adult Protective Services, Program Integrity, and Quality Assurance with Senior Disability Services. We've got a new protocol for how we're going to receive cases. They're going to review them for a credible allegation of fraud. And the goal there is that my investigators will be able to spend the majority of their time focusing on criminal investigations and putting their time to good use working on cases that I'm going to be able to prosecute. The last line I'd like to draw your attention to, which is the number of convictions. You'll see we had 4 in 2010, 1 in 11, 1 in 12. I took over the unit at the beginning of 2013. We had 19 convictions that year, and so far in fiscal year 2014, we have 25 cases that have resulted in convictions.
Can you repeat that for those that are home listening?
I apologize.
Can you repeat that for those that are home listening?
Certainly. So looking at the last line, which is our number of convictions for the various fiscal years, federal fiscal years, in 2010, we had 4 convictions. In federal fiscal year 2011, we had 1. In 2012, we had 1. I took over the unit in 2013, and we started a new collaboration with the Department of Health. We were able to secure 19 criminal convictions in 2013. And so far in fiscal year 2014, we've secured 25 criminal convictions.
Thank you.
On page 8, Medicaid fraud statistics. This is a question that comes up a lot when I'm talking or providing presentations on Medicaid fraud, and that is, what's the percentage of Medicaid billing that's fraudulent? And I couldn't give you a number in Alaska what the percentage is. That's just not something that I would know. What I can tell you is from the FBI Financial Crimes Report 2010-2011, the FBI estimates that between 3 to 10% of all healthcare billing is fraudulent. I would say in my dealings with healthcare providers, I would say the majority are honest, diligent, providing good services. But looking at these numbers by the FBI, it's clear that fraud costs American taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And if the FBI's estimate holds true for the state of Alaska, this percentage equates to millions of dollars every year in fraud in the state of Alaska. And that result directly impacts, as Commissioner Struer was saying, those people that need the services. It takes the limited financial resources we have away from people that need it and going to those who don't.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Machiki, you have a question?
Mr. Poirier, you averaged last year 1.5 convictions a month. Right now you're on track for 300 total. I'm not sure what the statute of limitations are, but I assume we missed a lot in the past. Are you going to be looking backward for sort of retro violations, or what's your plan?
Well, the statute of limitations, to answer that portion of your question, and Senator Machiki to the chair, is 5 years generally. On fraud cases, we do have the option to, there's a look-back statute that allows us to go up to 8 years, but no more than 1 year past the date of discovery. So that would be our maximum period of time to look back. When I took over the unit, there were a number of old cases that were there. And with our recent collaboration with the Department of Health and other agencies that I'll talk about, we were generating so many new cases, we had to kind of make a decision. Are we going to work on the new stuff or the old? And we've been focusing on the newer cases at this point. I can look back. Some of the cases, or a lot of the cases you'll see that we're making, are in the home healthcare arena. And one of the benefits, or one of the ways in which we're able to make these cases, is because home healthcare or personal healthcare attendants, PCAs, are enrolled providers. And it means we have the ability to identify who they are. And I'll tell you this, just kind of as an aside, Alaska is only one of 2 states which identifies the providers in the personal care attendant arena. And it is, I guess in conferences that I've been to where I tell other Medicaid fraud control unit directors about that, they're actually quite envious. I mean, that is Alaska's ahead of the curve in that area. Part of the reason we have the high number of convictions that we have is because of the work we've been doing over the past year. A lot of those are coming to fruition, and then we'll have to start over again on new cases. But I don't suspect we'll hit 300 cases.
Okay.
Going back to the fraud statistics, just a couple of other important issues is the FBI crime statistics indicate that the fraud schemes are becoming more sophisticated and increasingly complex. And based upon my experience over the last 15 months, I would agree with that. I am noticing that the schemes we're finding, they are incredibly complex, and they're not just here in Alaska, they're nationwide schemes. Something that may pop up in Maryland, I talk to prosecutors out there, I start looking here, we find the same schemes are being utilized here. So there's kind of a nationwide trend of providers to utilize the same tactics. Once a weakness is found within the system, it's exploited everywhere. And so that's another benefit of being part of the National Medicaid Fraud Control Units, is that we are able to share that information and utilize it from state to state. And last, the FBI indicates that the best way to attack Medicaid fraud is through collaboration with other agencies that are part of the system, and that's what I'd like to talk about now on page 9. When I took over with the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, one of the first things we started doing was coordinating our efforts with the Department of Health, specifically, as Commissioner mentioned, program integrity, quality assurance within the Senior and Disability Services section, healthcare services quality assurance program, and the behavioral health quality assurance. That, as well as the Department of Law's Civil Division. We have generally a meeting about every 6 weeks where we all get together. We identify cases of concern, areas of concern. I really try to take my lead from the Department of Health. They bring to me the issues that they want to see us investigate or areas or cases that they have concern with, and we figure out at that point, can we investigate them? Is there a potential case here that we could prosecute criminally? If there isn't, can we work with our counterpart in the Civil Division to go after them civilly for an overpayment? And if we can't do either of those, do we need to have a regulatory change or ask possibly for a statutory change to address the issue that we're seeing? And that's what we try to do on a regular basis. And Director Mays is here in the audience, but he's previously described it as being a three-legged stool between the Department of Law's Criminal and Civil Division and the Department of Health. When we all collaborate and work together like that, the system works a lot better. The other agencies identified on page 10 that we are currently collaborating with, we work closely with the Alaska State Troopers. My investigators, I'm very fortunate to have some very skilled investigators from a number of different areas. I have a police detective who is a retired officer with 30 years experience. Two other former officers are on my team right now. We have an investigator from the Department of Public Assistance, another investigator who is a nurse investigator, and an investigator from occupational licensing. They all bring with them a vast amount of experience, but they aren't sworn peace officers. And so when we go in to execute a search warrant or have an arrest, we work closely with the Alaska State Troopers or the Anchorage Police Department. We're also working closely with the municipality of Anchorage on a lot of our taxi cases. And then the other agencies we deal with on a regular basis, the Office of Inspector General, OIG, as we refer to them, they're the Health and Human Services special agents. They're our funding source, and they provide us with direct support in almost all of our cases. The FBI, Immigration and Customs Enforcement help us on a regular basis on probably more than half of our cases. And then we've worked with the Social Security Administration, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and actually the United States Postal Service on a number of cases. So it's interesting how we work with all these other agencies, including other state agencies like the Department of Labor, Department of Commerce, and Corrections, to really to bring together a full picture when we start investigating a fraud case. Page 11 is just a little bit of general information about a referral source and how cases come to us. As I previously indicated, they come from the Department of Health. We've also established a website with an online option for people to report fraud. They can do it anonymously. They can provide us with information. The online source is really quite helpful because they can fill in essential information that they might not be willing to give us otherwise. It gives us the ability to look into those type of cases. We've had citizens come to us, APD officers. So we get referrals from a number of different sources. We screen those for credibility, and if they look like it's a credible allegation of fraud, we proceed ahead. If not, we may screen the case out. We may refer it back to, for example, program integrity for an overpayment, if it's not a criminal act, but maybe it was a failure to document. With respect to Medicaid suspensions, the commissioner mentioned, I believe, 57 suspensions, and that was in 2013. So far, going into 2014, we have a total now of 62 suspensions based on credible allegations of fraud. And these are suspensions from receiving payment from Medicaid. So once a credible allegation is determined, There may be an ongoing criminal case that hasn't finalized, but program integrity through federal regulations is obligated at the point we determine that there's a credible allegation of fraud and that suspending them from payment won't negatively impact our criminal case. Program integrity then suspends them from receiving any further payment until the outcome of their case. This has had, we've made a couple of changes in that area as well. Historically, my unit would always ask, please don't suspend until we file criminal charges. What we've started to do is once we've conducted our interviews and we have the fact that we're investigating is no longer secret or confidential to the potential subject, we give the information back to the Department of Health for their determination of a credible allegation. That has resulted in a significant number of suspensions well in advance of the time at which I can get criminal charges filed, thus saving the state money in those areas. Some of the areas in which we've had payment suspensions, there's been one home health care agency that has been suspended. That agency was billing about $12 million a year. A transportation service provider was suspended. That company went from billing nothing when they started. Within 6 months, they were billing $150,000 a month. Two medical practices have been suspended from billing Medicaid, and a total of 58 individual home health care attendants. Program Integrity did a cost savings estimate, and they estimated that would save the state about $15 million.
That $15 million, that's not an annual number. That's a projection over how long the culprits could have produced this fraudulent billings?
Yeah, my understanding, Senator Stedman, is the way that was calculated is by looking at the individual company that was, or the individual or company that was committing the fraud, and projecting back what they billed in the past 12 months, and determining that would be the future savings. It's a little bit difficult to project going forward how much it would be, because a number of the people, for example, in the home health care agency, still have to receive services, and they go ultimately to other agencies. With respect to our prosecutions, between October of 2012 to present, the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit has charged 72 criminal cases. Those cases focus in areas of personal health care attendance, for example, billing for services not being provided. And this can run a gamut of different things. Oftentimes we find that individuals are traveling internationally and billing for services that they claim to be providing when maybe the recipient is international and the provider's here, or vice versa. Current federal law prohibits the payment for Medicaid services while traveling internationally. So even if both the provider and the recipient are traveling together, they can't receive payment for that. We're also finding issues of back billing, or simply just billing for services you're not provided because you're someplace else. Double billing for time. Individuals that are taking care of multiple recipients, we're finding that they're billing for both recipients simultaneously, and or billing while the recipient's hospitalized. And again, regulation prohibits somebody from billing for providing care to somebody when they're being cared for in a hospital type setting. We've also had three cases against assisted living home employees for endangering the welfare of a vulnerable adult, resulting in convictions. And we have a doctor and an office manager, which are currently charged, and those are ongoing cases. On page 14, the more pertinent results. Between October of 2012 and present, we have received or secured 44 criminal convictions. All 44 of these individuals are suspended from providing Medicaid services going forward. The conviction is what's called a barrier crime, and unless the Department of Health gives them a variance, they will not be allowed to bill Medicaid again in the future. We've secured $226,000 in restitution for the current convictions, and we've had two civil resolutions, and those are in cases where it just turned out that it was better to resolve the case civilly and place certain restrictions on the providers. With respect to our pending cases, we have a number of pending cases and ongoing investigation. the estimated potential recovery, and again, this is just a potential recovery if we're able to prove the allegations, is between $1.3 and $3 million in restitution in addition to what we've already secured. The last area I want to talk about was just some of the notable cases that we've had, and these cases have been really helpful as we've gone through these cases. Once we've secured a conviction, we're able to go back to Commissioner Struer or his folks within the Department of Health, and we're able to discuss with them some of the lessons we've learned from these cases and issues that we might address to prevent this type of fraud. The first case is State versus Batak. Ms. Batak was a municipality of Anchorage employee in the property tax division. And she was also an employee at Home Depot. And what was happening in Mrs. Batak's case is she was working as a personal care attendant. She was billing the state for providing home health care services while she was actually working at Home Depot or traveling internationally. We were able to, with the help of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, we were able to identify her periods of international travel. Home Depot helped us out with her time cards, and we were able to place her at work when she was actually billing the state. The fraud committed by Ms. Batak was $64,000, and that resulted in a felony conviction for her with 1 year in prison and a 10-year period of probation. She does have the option, if she pays back the state the $64,000 that she stole, she can apply for early termination of her probation after 3 years. So there's kind of an incentive built in to encourage her to pay the state back the money that she owes. The next case on page 16 is State v. Goons. And this case has been extremely interesting for a number of reasons. Most notably, Mr. Goons, a taxi cab driver in Anchorage, defrauded the Medicaid system $100. What he was doing was he was taking Medicaid vouchers for rides that were prohibited. So Medicaid provides vouchers to recipients for rides to go from home to the hospital or approved locations. He was taking the voucher for an unapproved location, and then he was falsely submitting to Medicaid a claim that was greater than the ride he actually provided. Unfortunately for Mr. Goons, they were federal agents that went on the ride with him, and he agreed to a plea bargain that we offered him. The more interesting part of this case is that the municipality of Anchorage then stepped in. They suspended his ability to be a chauffeur or to have a chauffeur's license for a period of 5 years. They revoked his taxi cab permit, and they're now auctioning off his taxi cab permit. Estimated value is about $39,000. In kind of continuing on with the theme of transportation cases, we have an ongoing investigation. Again, this is just an allegation only, but that this taxi company is billing for services that they weren't providing. This case is currently with the U.S. Attorney's Office. Again, in working with the municipality of Anchorage, the interesting thing here is the consequences for this type of fraudulent behavior. Currently, the company is suspended from billing Medicaid. They can't receive any payments, and that was the only source of their funding. The second thing is that the municipality of Anchorage revoked all five of their permits, and as a result of this investigation and collaboration with the municipality has changed its regulations on what type of services, what type of escort services can be provided by this type of a company, and they've barred this type of company from accepting Medicaid vouchers. So again, the collaboration with different state and federal agencies is really, I believe, resulting in a significant savings for the state of Alaska. Finally, the last case to talk about is a personal health care attendant case that was really brought to us by the Department of Health Quality Assurance in the Senior and Disability Services Division. Lincoln and Cruz with the Senior and Disability Services identified an area in which there appeared to be fraudulent billing going on by this one individual company. The investigation in collaboration with the FBI, Office of Inspector General, the Department of Health, and the Anchorage Police Department resulted in July 9th, 29 criminal charges being filed. Of that, 27 of the charges were from the one company alone. In that case, just in that one charging round, identified $346,000 in fraudulent activity. So far, there's been 44 individuals from that company charged, and the investigation's ongoing with respect to the company. Finally, just the lessons learned on the last page, on page 19. I think it's probably the most notable is the value in cooperation with the different agencies. What we're trying to do is efficiently utilize the limited financial resources that you are all providing us, utilizing everybody's expertise. Certainly when we go in and do search warrants, we always ask that Commissioner Stewart's folks attend us on those warrants because they are the subject matter experts. They can help us to identify the information that we need when we're on scene. And we're working diligently with the Department of Health to identify weaknesses and solutions in the programs, as I indicated previously, identifying where we need regulatory changes. I previously indicated the state of Alaska is really quite innovative in regulating their home health care programs, and the high level of cooperation we have between the Department of Law and the Department of Health is something that is not consistent nationwide. There's a lot of states where they just don't have that level of cooperation, and the results is directly noted in the number of prosecutions that they have. And last, I think the important thing to note is just really the what's called the sentinel effect, or for prosecutors, we look at it as a general deterrence. We have had a number of investigations in which we've contacted individuals suspected of committing fraud, and we found out not only did they commit the fraud, but they've already started to repay back the state of Alaska the money that they billed for services they didn't provide because they recognize now that we're prosecuting some of these cases. So I think the end of the day, while those numbers are hard to measure, the state of Alaska is seeing a dramatic savings from the prosecutions that we're going forward with.
Any questions? I have a brief comment. A couple of years ago, as earlier you mentioned, there was a budgetary increment for the Department of Law.
Correct.
For fraud investigators. And it's kind of nice to sit down with the Department of Law, go over their budget issues, and see that they expressed some concern that this was a place where there's some softness. We incremented up the budget, and then 2 years later, 3 years later, here we have some positive results that is being delivered to all the citizens of the state as we bring this fraud out. Clearly, we want to help the needy, even not the greedy around here.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a quick comment. I mean, it looks like
cheeky.
Looks like we're up to potential levels here that could fund another state program for these are large quantities of dollars, and congratulate you for your efforts. I would have had no idea that we had this level of fraud going on in our state. So thanks for your hard work.
Thank you, Senator.
Thanks. Thanks to you and the commissioner. And the team effort is duly noted also. Are there any final comments for the presentations? This is going to conclude the meeting today. We're going to get the schedule up, be posted by 4 o'clock tomorrow. But for those of you at home, we'll be working on presentations dealing with some of the meth issues that we have in our communities and how we in the legislature could help our communities. There's some grassroots efforts as the citizens come together to push back because the police departments have, quite frankly, are overwhelmed or having some challenges dealing with the issue. So we're putting that stuff together. I think we'll find it interesting, and hopefully a couple of years from today we'll have another meeting like this and we'll have positive results in that arena. With that, we are adjourned.